Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, October 14, 2022. Secretary of the Treasury Janet Yellen says lowering inflation is President Biden's top economic priority as she speaks with reporters during the annual meeting of the IMF and World Bank in Washington, looking at the U.S. and world economic outlooks. She also gets a question about ongoing conversations to put a global price cap on Russian oil. A debate tonight in the close Georgia Senate election between the incumbent Democrat Raphael Warnock and the Republican challenger Herschel Walker. Some saying the winner of that contest could determine which party has a majority in the Senate. We'll get a preview with a political reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Congresswoman Liz Cheney, vice chair of the January 6th committee, asked why the committee waited until yesterday, the last hearing before Election Day, to subpoena former President Donald Trump. British Prime Minister Liz Truss firing her finance minister and changing course on proposed tax cuts that have upset financial markets in that country. And Secretary of State Antony Blinken meeting with Iranian activists as protests continue in Iran over the death of a 22-year-old woman in custody of the morality police. She was arrested for not wearing a headscarf correctly. And we start at the annual World Bank Group and International Monetary Fund meeting in Washington, D.C. The IMF.org website writes, the meeting brings together central bankers, ministers of finance and development, private sector executives, civil society, and academics to discuss issues of global concern, including the world economic outlook, global financial stability, poverty eradication, jobs and growth, economic development, and aid effectiveness. The U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen holding a news conference today as the meeting continues through the weekend, talking about the state of the U.S. and global economies.
I spoke this week to my counterparts in the G7 and the broader community about the diverse and difficult challenges that face the global economy today. Many of these challenges stem from Russia's terrible war in Ukraine and the continued recovery from the pandemic. Inflation is elevated in many countries. Growth is slowing globally. We're also seeing swings in capital flows and strong movements in financial markets. But we're taking strong action both in the United States and globally to contend with these headwinds. In the United States, our economy remains resilient, bolstered by President Biden's economic plan. But we're highly attuned to the risks of global headwinds. That includes those contributing to the high inflation we've seen in much of the world. Bringing down elevated inflation remains President Biden's top economic priority, even as we know the Federal Reserve plays the primary role in maintaining stable prices. Yesterday's CPI report shows that we have more work to do to get price increases under control. While some leading indicators show hopeful signs, working families are continuing to feel the pain of high inflation. Our administration is continuing to take a broad range of actions to boost energy supply, address housing constraints, and provide cost relief in areas like health care. It can take time to see the impact of these actions, but we know that they have and will continue to make a meaningful difference.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, news conference at the World Bank IMF meeting in Washington, D.C., part of her opening statement. One of the reporters' questions to her about a Russian oil price cap, with the Wall Street Journal reporting that the G7, group of seven top industrialized countries, that would include the United States, Britain, Japan, Canada, France, Germany, and Italy, and Australia in this discussion, working to finalize an agreement ahead of a December 5th deadline to bar the use of financing, insuring, and shipping services for Russian oil unless the oil is sold below a set price limit.
Hi, Secretary Yellen. I wanted to ask on oil and the price cap again. Sounds like discussions are now focused on the price, what the price of the cap will be. You said earlier this week that something in the 60s could be something that a level that would allow Russia to, you know, maintain an incentive to produce. I'm curious, just is that the high 60s, low 60s, just where, you know, where you are on the price?
So I want to be very clear about what I said and what's happening with this. The coalition of countries that are imposing these services bans will jointly decide on what the appropriate price is. It's also a price that can be adjusted over time once a decision is made about the level, and no decisions have been made. I did not say that under consideration is a price in the 60s. I simply said there are several what I meant to say is that there are several benchmarks that are relevant in deciding what a price should be. One question is, what is the marginal cost for Russia of producing oil? And so there will certainly, to charge a price less than that would certainly cause Russia to want to shut in oil. They don't want to sell oil at a loss. So that's one benchmark for discussion. Another benchmark is, let's look at history and see what prices has Russia earned in the past and found acceptable and profitable to produce and sell oil. One thing we want to be clear about is that Russia should not profit from having started this atrocious war in Ukraine and shouldn't be benefiting from profits that result from those atrocities. So we're looking historically at what have oil prices been that Russia has earned, and it was in that context that I mentioned a specific number, range. But no decision has been made, and I did not say that that's what the price is that's under contemplation. No decision's been made.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen at today's news conference at the World Bank IMF meeting in Washington. Business Insider reporting oil prices rose to highs near $130 a barrel in early March in the weeks after Russia invaded Ukraine, but they have trended lower since June, falling almost 25% thanks to concerns a weakening global economy will dampen demand. Wall Street today, the Dow down 403, NASDAQ down 327, S&P down 86. Securities and Exchange Commission Chair Gary Gensler calling on Congress to give another agency, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, more powers to regulate cryptocurrency stablecoins. He says to reduce risk to the financial system. A Reuters article explains stablecoins are usually pegged to the U.S. dollar and are primarily used to facilitate trading in other digital assets. Chair Gensler is speaking today at a forum hosted by Georgetown University's Center for Financial Markets and Policy.
So I think, and I've joined together with Secretary Yellen and Chair Powell and my colleagues of the President's Working Group, suggesting that one area is with regard to stable coins. And I'm going to distinguish between two types of coins, but there are coins that are backed by, or purportedly backed by U.S. dollar. There's three large ones, and they're used inside of the crypto intermediaries, inside the crypto system today, that $140, $150 billion of them. Those have a lot of similarities to money market funds. And in a low interest rate environment, weren't necessarily directly paying interest, but often were giving rewards and yields and other returns. And how to look at that if those particularly moved into the payment system, if they became e-monies. And so we've talked about it at the President's Working Group and the Financial Stability Oversight Council about what's the appropriate safety and soundness oversight on that group of stable coins. There's another group of stable coins that are simply just, similar to what I said earlier. There's a group of entrepreneurs that are saying they have value, and it's the value based upon some algorithm or some efforts of that entrepreneurial group and the like. But even that first group that is purportedly backed by the dollar right now could well be securities. But working with Congress on the safety and soundness side of that while the CFTC and SEC retain conduct authority. I think the CFTC could well have greater authorities. They currently do not have direct regulatory authorities over the underlying non-security tokens. They have anti-fraud, anti-manipulation, but actual plenary regulatory authority to write rules around the exchanges.
Securities and Exchange Commission Chair Gary Gensler taking part virtually in a forum at Georgetown University. More from the Reuters News article on his remarks. It remains unclear when Congress might pass crypto-related legislation, although several bills have been introduced to address stablecoins and digital commodities regulation. Now to campaign 2022. In Georgia, the race for U.S. Senator, the incumbent Democrat Raphael Warnock, debates the Republican challenger Herschel Walker tonight in Savannah. It's their only scheduled debate in one of the most competitive and potentially consequential elections in the country. It may very well decide which party controls the Senate. Coming up, we'll talk with a political reporter in Georgia. First, candidate Senator Raphael Warnock on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert Thursday night.
I was in the airport the other day, and this woman, she recognized me, but she didn't know why. And finally, she said, "Are you a politician?" I said, "I sure hope not. I'm in elected office, but I want to remain a public servant who serves in the office. And when I'm on the floor of the Senate trying to reduce the cost of insulin, I have an insulin bill which would reduce people's out-of-pocket cost to $35 per month per individual. I'm thinking about the families I've sat with whom I've seen struggle with diabetes when they've gotten the news that they have to have an amputation or will have to go on dialysis. $1 in $4 in our healthcare system is spent on somebody with diabetes. And so if we cap the costs, not only do we help those individuals, I think we do a lot in addressing our overall healthcare system. So the work that I do as a pastor and showing up and moving in the community, and people are surprised to see me in the grocery store. One of the things I've learned as a pastor is you can't serve the people if you don't spend time with the people, if you don't love the people. And that's the work that I'm trying to do. I think there's no shortage of transactional politicians in Washington who are so focused on the next election that they're not thinking about the next generation. That is what caused you to be unable to do anything after Columbine, after Sandy Hook. It's politicians thinking about themselves. So, yeah, I got an election, but I'm going to stay focused on the people.
Senator Raphael Warnock, Democrat from Georgia, on The Late Show on CBS Thursday night. On Tuesday, C-SPAN covered his Republican opponent, Herschel Walker, at a campaign rally in Carrollton, Georgia. You're going to hear him reference an elevator that was part of an introductory joke he told.
They'll do whatever it takes, will say whatever they have to say because they want this seat right here. But I don't think they know that they woke up a bear. Hey, I'm not just a dog now, I'm a bear. So they got to bring more than that. Because what they don't know is, hey, the gas prices, hey, my family can't take that. What they don't know is wokeness in my military. No, my family can't take that. What they don't know is I don't want them calling my men and women in blue thugs and criminals. No, I can't take that. It is time for us to stand up. It's time for us to straighten up. And don't let them take us down in that elevator. Yeah, I think I'm sick and tired of it. I hope you're sick and tired of it. Have you seen the crime in the streets? Hey, have you seen that border wide open? But I'm going to tell you something you may not know. 70% of the drugs coming from that border goes through Atlanta. That means you're going to have all the crime. You're going to have all the human trafficking. And what is Senator Warnock doing is absolutely nothing. And right now, he's going to talk sweet to you. He's going to dress nice. But 2 years, he's been in office. And can you take six more of this here? You can't take six more of this. It's time for us to get champions there that's going to get behind our military. It's time for us to get champions there that are going to get behind our police officer. It's time for us to get champions there that are going to get behind our kids in school, that they can quit calling our parents domestic terrorists because they want to know what's being taught in our schools.
Herschel Walker on Tuesday in Carrollton, Georgia. Atlanta Journal-Constitution political reporter Greg Bluestein has been covering the Georgia Senate election and joins us now from Savannah, where tonight's debate will be taking place. In fact, he's at the hotel where it'll happen. Thank you so much. You know, a lot of articles being written about this debate are using the phrase make or break. How important is it for each candidate?
You know, I don't see it as make or break because both candidates will certainly declare victory. And to many of their supporters who won't be tuning in, because it's a Friday night, it's high school football night in Georgia. It's Braves playoff night in Georgia. So a number of folks will not be watching. They'll just see it on social media. They'll see it on their newscast. And they'll probably see it through the lens of whichever candidate they support anyway. So I don't know if it's make or break. But I mean, surely it's just like any debate. A giant gaffe, a big, huge blunder could be devastating. But I think both these candidates are going to try their very best just to hit the other guy where it hurts and promote their own views.
And what issues have defined this race?
Oh, so many. I mean, where do we start? Senator Warnock is kind of running towards the middle. It's really interesting. He has consolidated the Democratic base, and he's aiming for those swing voters who are Republicans, independents, moderates, who are signaling that they just can't support Herschel Walker. Herschel Walker has this legendary name recognition in Georgia as a former college football star at the University of Georgia. But at the same time, he has this history of baggage, violent and erratic behavior, falsehoods, lies, exaggerations, conspiracy theories, blunders on the campaign trail. All of that is mixing into this cocktail even before the Daily Beast abortion reports that were really damaging his hopes. And he has to prove that he is someone who, you know, the mainstream Republicans can vote for.
Georgia has a now famous runoff law because it's happened very recently, which no candidate gets over 50%. It goes to runoff. Are there any third-party candidates who might cause it this time?
Yeah, this runoff law has been in effect for decades in Georgia, so it is a sad fact of life for us in Georgia that a lot of, you know, sometimes big-ticket races end up in overtime. There is a change this year where instead of a 9-week runoff like we saw in 2021, the runoff is only 4 weeks, so we'll have a decision by early December if there is a runoff. But there is a Libertarian candidate. His name is Chase Oliver. And, you know, he doesn't have a well-financed campaign. He doesn't have a high profile. But he's polling better than most Libertarians poll, in part because of what I just talked about, which are he's becoming a home for disaffected Republican voters who just can't vote for Herschel Walker, but they don't want to vote for Walker or Warnock. So they're signaling their support for him. They're going to support him, and he's at about 4% in some recent polls.
We're talking with Greg Bluestein from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. This race between Herschel Walker and Senator Warnock getting national attention. But on the ground there, what does it look like day-to-day?
On the ground, we haven't seen much of a change in the polls recently, even with some bombshells that have come out in the recent days, just a week ago, really. A week and a half ago, we still see in an AJC University of Georgia poll conducted with dozens of other media entities in Georgia, Herschel Walker's at 43, Walker Warnock's at 46. That's within the margin of error. I can tell you that both campaigns say there's a likelihood right now of a runoff. So we could once again be in overtime in Georgia and maybe have control of the Senate on the line.
And how much money has been poured into this race?
A lot. More than $300 million has been reserved or spent on TV ads in Georgia, most of that for the Senate campaign, but a significant number as well for the governor's race between Stacey Abrams and the incumbent Republican Brian Kemp. Folks are sick and tired of all the ads, but we're used to it because almost $1 billion was spent in Georgia in the last election cycle between the presidential race and the two Senate runoffs. So we're getting kind of, we're girding for a lot more negative ads. Can't turn on a TV, a radio, streaming platform, anything without seeing campaign ads. And unfortunately, some of them are not just are they brutal like you'd expect, but you know, my kids are watching them. So my kids are saying, Daddy, what's with this thing with Warnock? Or what's with this thing with Herschel Walker? Tell me about it. And I have to go explain to my 8-year-old, this or that allegation.
Greg Bluestein is a political reporter with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, joining us from Savannah, where tonight's debate will be taking place between Senator Raphael Warnock, the Democratic incumbent, and the Republican challenger Herschel Walker. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
From Yahoo News, former President Donald Trump on Friday released a letter to Congressman Benny Thompson, Democrat from Mississippi, chair of the House Select Committee investigating the Capitol riot of January 6, 2021, after the panel voted to subpoena former President Trump over his role in the insurrection. In the 14-page letter, which includes a 10-page appendix and photos of the crowd at his rally that preceded the attack, former President Trump rants about the committee's investigation and repeats false claims about the 2020 election. But the former president did not say whether he would comply with a subpoena. "Dear Chairman Thompson, the presidential election of 2020 was rigged and stolen," the letter begins, before launching into a litany of complaints and grievances. That from Yahoo News. Former President Trump on Thursday, after that vote to subpoena him, also posing the question on his social media platform, "Why didn't the unselect committee," he writes, "ask me to testify months ago?" He answers his own question, "Because the committee is a total bust." Today, Congresswoman Liz Cheney, Republican from Wyoming, the committee's vice chair, also getting that question.
"Why did the committee wait till the last day of the hearings to subpoena the president? Why not on day one?"
Well, it's not necessarily the last day of the hearings. But I think we have felt it's very important that the investigation be conducted in a way that is rigorous and disciplined and responsible. And that has meant collecting evidence from many, if not all, because of course some people took the fifth or some people refused to appear, but collecting evidence from all of those around the central figure in January 6th before we issued a subpoena for him. And so that's what we've done.
One last question from me. You talked how you're a Republican, you're a conservative. What would you say to those conservatives who might say something like the following? Yes, I know Trump lacks the character to be president. I don't really like him much. But at least he stood up to the woke mob and the cultural elite. And he defends folks like us who are traditionally religious. At least he fought for us and gave voice to us that establishment Republicans never have and never seem to do.
I would have a lot to say to those people. You know, I would say, first of all, there is nothing Christian or faithful in any religion about someone who sits by and allows violence that he sparked to occur and refuses to take action to stop it, to save people's lives. And secondly, I would say that wokeism is a real problem. Cancel culture is a real problem. We have to respect and honor the First Amendment, especially on our college campuses. But the response to wokeism cannot be that conservatives torch the Constitution. And we have to be able to maintain our fidelity to the Constitution because the Constitution's our shield. And if we abandon it because following it doesn't lead to the outcome that we prefer, then we will not have it as a shield when we are faced with threats to our First Amendment rights or our Second Amendment rights or any of the rights that are protected by the Constitution. And we also have to be, we have to conduct ourselves in politics in a way that is faithful to and encourages people to put their trust in us. If you are a conservative and you believe in conservative policies, then you have an obligation to make your case to people and to go out and conduct yourself in a way that explains why we believe in those policies. And it cannot be, as we discussed before, that the American people have to choose between wokeism, socialism, and insurrection. That cannot be the choice for the future of the country. And we have to be able to present a different and better substantive alternative that's faithful to the Constitution.
Congresswoman Liz Cheney, Republican from Wyoming, January 6th committee vice chair, at a discussion on the future of democracy in America held at Notre Dame University, South Bend, Indiana. Breitbart has a story that two leading Republicans wrote a letter Friday to the National Archives demanding communications and documents addressing the possibility Democrats pressured the institution into investigating former President Donald Trump. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now video app and wherever you get your podcasts. To London, this from Associated Press, embattled British Prime Minister Liz Truss sacked her Treasury chief and reversed course on a major part of her tax-cutting economic plan Friday, as she struggled to hang on to her job after weeks of turmoil on financial markets. But the market response was muted, and the political reaction to what many saw as panicked moves left Prime Minister Truss's credibility in tatters after only 6 weeks in office. The Prime Minister held a news conference talking about the change in policy and the firing of the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Kwasi Kwarteng.
People across this country rightly want stability. That's why we acted to support businesses and households with their energy costs this winter. It's also the case that global economic conditions are worsening due to the continuation of Putin's appalling war in Ukraine. And on top of this, debt was amassed helping people through the COVID pandemic. But it is clear that parts of our mini budget went further and faster than markets were expecting. So the way we are delivering our mission right now has to change. We need to act now to reassure the markets of our fiscal discipline. I have therefore decided to keep the increase in corporation tax that was planned by the previous government. This will raise £18 billion per year. It will act as a down payment on our full medium-term fiscal plan, which will be accompanied by a forecast from the independent OBR. We will do whatever is necessary to ensure debt is falling as a share of the economy in the medium term. We will control the size of the state to ensure that taxpayers' money is always well spent. Our public sector will become more efficient to deliver world-class services for the British people. And spending will grow less rapidly than previously planned. I met the former Chancellor earlier today. I was incredibly sorry to lose him. He is a great friend, and he shares my vision to set this country on the path to growth. Today, I have asked Jeremy Hunt to become the new Chancellor. He's one of the most experienced and widely respected government ministers and parliamentarians, and he shares my convictions and ambitions for our country.
British Prime Minister Liz Truss at a news conference in London. After her opening statement, she took a few questions, all of which were on one theme. You campaigned for prime minister on this agenda, and now that you are scrapping it, why should you not lose your job?
Can I start with Ben Reilly Smith, Telegraph?
Thank you, Prime Minister. Clearly a difficult day. Can you explain to the public why you think you should remain as prime minister, given you've junked a key tax cut that led you to be elected and got rid of your chancellor?
I'm absolutely determined to see through what I have promised, to deliver a higher growth, more prosperous United Kingdom, to see us through the storm we face. We've already delivered the energy price guarantee, making sure people aren't facing huge bills this winter. But it was right in the face of the issues that we had that I acted decisively to ensure that we have economic stability, because that is vitally important to people and businesses right across our country.
British Prime Minister Liz Truss at a news conference in London. More from the Associated Press article, Prime Minister Truss is facing pressure from across the political spectrum. The opposition Liberal Democrats called for an emergency weekend session of the House of Commons for Jeremy Hunt to provide more detail on the government's economic plan. Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon called for an early general election, and the BBC reported that a group of senior conservative lawmakers are planning to call for the prime minister's resignation next week. Back to Washington, D.C., Secretary of State Antony Blinken meeting with civil society activists from Iran as massive street protests in Iran are now in week number 5 following the death of a 22-year-old woman while in the custody of Iran's morality police, brought into custody for not wearing her headscarf correctly. AFP reports young women have been on the front line of the protest, shouting anti-government slogans, removing their headscarves, and facing off with security forces in the street. Secretary Blinken hosting the Iranian activists at the State Department.
Good morning, everyone. We're gathered today as we see remarkable displays of courage throughout Iran as women, young people, and many others continue to stand up for the fundamental rights that continue to be denied them by the Iranian regime. This is, in many ways, not a new story. This has been going on for years, for decades. But in the wake of Mahsa Amini's death and the spontaneous demonstration of outrage that this has produced, I think we are seeing something that is quite remarkable throughout the country, led primarily by women and young people. This denial of fundamental rights, fundamental freedoms, is something that the United States has long worked against, as have many other countries around the world. But first and foremost, this is the Iranian people standing up with extraordinary courage for the rights that are being denied them. We've worked to support those who are standing for their fundamental freedoms despite the efforts of the regime to deny them the ability to assemble, to speak freely, to communicate with each other. We've imposed sanctions on the so-called morality police that are engaged in incredibly abusive practices. We have, of course, worked to license technology so that the Iranians have the ability to communicate with one another and to communicate with the outside world. But today, I was especially eager to hear from colleagues who've themselves, in many different ways, been on the front lines of the struggle for fundamental freedom and fundamental rights in Iran, to hear from them, to listen to them, to learn from them. The final thing is this. I know that the Iranian regime will try to paint this and other expressions of solidarity with those standing up for their freedoms as evidence that these protests are somehow made outside of Iran and the work of others. And if that's the case, if they genuinely believe that, they fundamentally do not understand their own people, because this is about Iran's struggle, the struggle of the people of Iran, for the fundamental freedoms that have long been denied them. That's what this is about, and the sooner the regime understands that and acts on that, the better everyone will be. Thank you.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Amnesty International this week releasing a report showing at least 23 children, some as young as 11 years old, were killed by Iranian security forces in the last 10 days of September. The group accusing the Iranian security of targeting young people with absolute impunity. Accusations between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia growing this week over the decision by OPEC plus countries to cut oil production, which will likely raise gas prices, and help OPEC plus member Russia, after Saudi Arabia released a statement saying the decision was unanimous and purely for economic reasons. Reuters reports that the U.S. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said that more than one OPEC member disagreed with Saudi Arabia's push to cut production and felt coerced into the vote. and the United States presented Saudi Arabia with an analysis showing there was no market basis to lower oil production before the OPEC Plus decision to cut output. President Biden has been saying that Saudi Arabia will face consequences, and then he'll talk to Congress about what those will be. Today, Congressman Ro Khanna, Democrat from California, talking about his proposal to ban U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia.
This is a moment like Khashoggi. After Khashoggi's murder, the Sanders and my bipartisan War Powers Resolution gained a lot of momentum. Before that, people weren't paying attention to the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. But we actually passed the War Powers Resolution, first time a War Powers Resolution has ever passed in the history of Congress. And then again, we started to ignore some of the Saudi atrocities. But I think this has galvanized the Congress again. And it is a direct slap in the face of Americans. It reeks of ingratitude, given all the arms we provide the Saudis. I mean, literally, their airplanes couldn't fly if it weren't for American technicians. And the timing of it is suspect. It also is a slap in the face of the president who went to Saudi Arabia to try to engage. So I believe there will be consequences. This is a miscalculation strategically from the Saudis. And I anticipate the White House will take action and that there's broad support in the Congress to take action.
Congressman Ro Khanna, Democrat from California, at a discussion on U.S.-Saudi relations hosted by the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. At the regular State Department briefing with reporters, the principal deputy spokesman Vedant Patel asked about the possible Biden administration response.
On Saudi Arabia, whenever people talk about implications of OPEC decision on Saudi Arabia, we hear in Washington about banning or stopping arms sales to Saudi Arabia. In the past, we have seen whenever Gulf countries were denied of U.S. arms, they turned to China. How confident are you that any of such move would be effective against Gulf countries to make them divert their course?
Well, like I said, I don't have any specific actions to preview and don't want to get ahead of the ball here. But I also want to, again, reiterate that, you know, we have a multiplicity of interests with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And, of course, a big component of that is the nearly 70,000 American citizens who live in the kingdom. And, of course, their security is of great importance to this administration. And we certainly wouldn't want to do anything that impedes on their security, but also on the United States' own national security in the kingdom or in the region itself. But, again, I don't want to get ahead of any actions that many might be speculating upon.
OPEC Plus is consisting of large number of countries, almost all Gulf countries. Why is it Saudi Arabia on the hot spot now? Is there a specific reason?
Well, look, I think you saw Admiral Kirby speak to this a little bit earlier this week, but other OPEC nations communicated to us privately that they disagreed with the decision that was taken earlier this week. And as the president has said, we're reevaluating our relationship with Saudi Arabia in light of that. And we'll continue to look for ways to take additional steps. But again, I don't have anything additional to preview.
State Department Principal Deputy Spokesman Vedant Patel. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter Word for Word for the stories Washington is talking about sent to your inbox every day. Subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night and weekend.